Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story of the book. Coming to you from Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And it's also a perfect place for solar energy. And I just want to remind you, if you are looking for solar energy, goehs.com is the place for you to go. Now, this is a very special day, and we're going to spend, we have a song for you. A little bit of a birthday song that we're going to play. And I want to tell you, this is a very special day because I have a guest, and we are going to be celebrating a birthday today of somebody. Well, we're celebrating the book and the song. Here we go. It's your birthday today. It's somebody's birthday today. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Jerome Pressler, who is the author, a renowned author of the Dark Web series and NetForce, Dark Web, and all sorts of exciting books, thrillers that he has written. But the story that we're going to talk about today is it's a historical thriller. I am so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper, Jerome.
Hi, Patsy. Good to be back.
Well, it's great
to hear your effervescent voice and your theme music.
Well, thank you. You know, I am so happy that I thought of this idea because I love your book, and this is one of the stories that I think is so wonderful. When I come across a book that I didn't know about and a story that I didn't know about. So today we are celebrating the birthday of Will Cushing. And you have to tell my listeners, the ones who haven't yet heard about it, but I talk about it quite often, about this wonderful book, Civil War Commando.
Well, gee, where do we start? First of all, happy by my reckoning, 179th birthday, Will. And also, I think it's worth mentioning, as we discuss him a little bit, that it's actually also just past the anniversary of his greatest mission, which took place, or his most famous mission, which took place on, I believe it was October 28th, 1864. So we're just about, a week past that. And that was a commando raid against an ironclad warship called the Confederate warship called the CSS Albemarle. And a brief little bit of background on that. The Albemarle was, as I said, an ironclad. It was among the handful of early ironclad warships as opposed to wooden warships that were being used at the time. This was the point in history when navies were transitioning from wood to iron, and it was the most fearsome vessel in the Confederate Navy. It was considered unsinkable. It was really a terror to the to Union forces, both naval and land forces, and there were many attempts to sink it. All of them led to disaster, at least if you were on the Union side. And along came our barely 21-year-old, I think at that point, Will Cushing, who had been had a very checkered career that we can talk about a little bit later. He was booted out of the Naval Academy. He was booted out of the Navy. He was considered a reject and a failure. And he winds up leading a commando-style mission to destroy the Albemarle, we won't get into whether he succeeds or not just yet, but I will say that he winds up being one of the most little-known storied heroes of the Civil War. And I say that because he was cited for a commendation by no one less than President Lincoln himself, as well as the Secretary of the Navy, and right now, there's a monumental monument, I think that's how I saw it described, to Will Cushing. Will Cushing is buried at the Naval Academy, from which he was once expelled, and is a really beautiful monument at his grave site that you can see photos of it on the internet, I think, but it's really something that I don't know if you can visit Annapolis right now or not, but it's something worth seeing once you learn a little bit about Will.
It definitely is. This is such an inspiring book. And, of course, the title is intriguing because most people never think of the Civil War as a commando type of operation. Yet he came out with some really great ideas here on how to fight. And it wasn't the, sort of the traditional way that we're sort of going to announce that we're coming after you. He went out and did some sneaky things. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, up until that point, what you're saying is exactly on the ball. During the Civil War, where the naval action was really on the Union's part, what they were trying to do was conduct interdiction operations against Southern shipping, and that would include all sorts of economic trade, military arms, supplies, as well as troop movement. So the method up to that point, which was completely unsuccessful, was that they would blockade Southern ports. And the reason they were unsuccessful was that if you look at the ports along the North Carolina and Virginia coast, what you see is a very uneven shoreline that consists of a lot of very, very narrow inlets, and so forth. So the Southern military was well acquainted with these, the Northern military not so well acquainted, and to actually take a very large warship and plant it in a stationary position off a harbor and think that it's going to stop people who know all of the different side routes and waterways that they can smuggle things through I don't want to say foolish, but it just wasn't going to work. So what Will started doing, and we have to give some credit to Will's mentor, a man named Charles Flusser, who was his mentor at the Naval Academy. Flusser began conducting these what Will called commando style raids, Will further developed them and took them to a new level. What Will did was he would launch off the big stationary vessel in small boats with anywhere between, you know, a half dozen, 10, 12 crewmen. They would go ashore. They would conduct these daring, crazy raids, you know, not really knowing what kind of force complements they'd be dealing with on the other side. So they didn't know how many troops were waiting for them or not waiting for them. But Will, being as crazy as he was, it really didn't care. So he would go ashore. He'd set fire to boats. He would seize hold of a post office to get hold of Confederate mail, hoping that he could get information, which he was able to do. At one point, he went ashore to kidnap a Confederate general. And although he was unsuccessful at that, he did in fact kidnap his second in command, I believe, and was able to hold him for ransom. Will was just utterly fearless and really pioneered these types of raids. So that when it came to the most famous raid, which was the attack on the Albemarle, he had spent over a year perfecting these techniques. And they were later adopted by the Navy, going from the Marine Leathernecks who conducted commando style raids to modern day Navy SEALs. All of those tactics and techniques really stemmed from Will. And again, I want to give credit to his mentor Flusser, who inspired Will and really gave him the the impetus and the freedom to go ahead and try this stuff.
Well, that's why Civil War Commando is so exciting. I thought I knew, I read a lot about the Civil War, and I thought I knew everything. And I was so surprised to discover that there were commandos. I always thought, the sailors stayed on the ships. And to discover this, and the way you lay out the story, is so exciting. It's a thriller. It's just as modern day in so many ways, because this is exactly what happens today. And, we have big ships go somewhere, and then we have all these, Navy SEALs coming off in these little, boats, and they head to shore, and they do this kind of stuff. But Will and his mentor started it and perfected it and it's thrilling. That's why the book, I recommend it all the time to people. I say, if you want a really thrilling book, you have to read Civil War Commando.
Well, I think one of the things that makes it that made it so interesting to me, and I think that hopefully I was able to do in the book, using a narrative or novelistic style, was really show Will's evolution. The thing about Will that really grabs you is that first of all, his entire naval career was a span of, or at least a week that I cover in the book, was a span of about 3 years. He died at, I believe he was 32 or 33 years old. The story goes up to his 21st to 22nd year of life, but I begin with Will's childhood. And Will came from although he had relatives that were fairly well placed socially and in government, and in many ways. That helped save him. Will himself and Will's immediate family was impoverished. His father left at an early age, and Will was, by the time he was 9 years old, really had to fend for himself. He had a number of siblings, one of whom also became famous and comported himself with great honor in the Civil War. But Will was really the kind of rough and tumble kid who, stood up for all his brothers, his sisters, and for the weak kids in the town in which he grew up in upstate New York. And he always had this wild streak that got him into trouble, but also kind of gave foresight into the man he would become if one, looking back through the prism of history. But this was a young kid who defended, the weakest kids in town, in his town, who befriended a kid who had tuberculosis when his family forbid him from visiting the kid because obviously they didn't want him to get sick, and he would sneak into the kid's bedroom to keep him company. This was stuff that he did later on, even as a young naval officer. I think in the book I actually talk about an episode. This is when he's before his more storied episodes, when he's a young officer aboard a ship and another young officer takes a terrible fall and ends up dying, and Will sits with him until the very end, won't leave his bedside. So you see this in Will, and you see, although you also see a kid who could be as a young man and as an adolescent, who could be violent at times and who could get himself into a lot of trouble, there was this noble, almost knightly streak in him. And he was, in his own mind and in reality, a romantic with a capital R figure. So he was this fascinating guy, and all of this is packed in to this few short years. So I think that's really what, that's the real color and texture and magic to his story for me. Of course, there's all, there's everything we're talking about, which realizes his potential. But it's that this was a guy who, again, just flunked out of the Naval Academy, was booted out of the Navy, just could not function in a disciplined situation, and yet put him in the right context, and he became a magnificent hero.
And he is. And what I love about him, first of all, when you think about someone that young doing what he did, and so you compare it to, you know, so many young people today who, you know, are get crazy if they don't have cell reception. You know, and you think here what he was doing. It's so amazing. The story is so beautifully told. I love the part where you write about his childhood. That takes, you know, that takes us into his life and exactly to understand what kind of a person he was. The storytelling in this book is so tremendous. I was blown away from the minute I read it, and I think that it's one of these books. I mentioned it before that this is a book that will be read 100 years from now, 200 years from now, when people go back and look and at books they want to read about the Civil War. This is a book that they will want to read because it tells the story so beautifully. I got so thrilled when I read it, and I really want to tell people, if you want a real thrill, get this book. And it's a wonderful gift to give. It's coming up to the holidays. This is just a wonderful, wonderful book. And let's talk a little bit about, we're not going to talk about what exactly happens in it, but when you mention about, you know, being kicked out of Annapolis, being having this special character of not giving up. This is so important. And for people to read it, I think this book is very inspiring.
Yeah, I agree. It certainly was to me. You know, I guess one of the things I saw in Will was that when I was in my teen years, I'd say, you know, high school and early college, I was kind of, you know, I had been, you know, been disillusioned with school and a lot of other stuff, and I was really not the kind of young man that anybody thought was going to really get anywhere. I really found that point of identification with Will, because I think that sometimes, you know, outside of these, sometimes there's some people or some of us who don't function as well in academic settings as others. And I don't even know that I or even Will at certain times had necessarily had, I don't know that I would call it a belief in myself. And I don't know that Will at times had a belief in himself. There were times in his life when Will was really lost, but there were a few people who came along and opened doors for him. And I think that's important to recognize as well, that there were just a smattering of people along the way. One instructor at Annapolis, one relative, a brother who knew what Will's inner makeup was, and who kept imploring others to say, "Give him a break. Look, you know, this guy has potential. This kid can become something special." Or this young man could become something special. And for me, that's really inspiring. I kind of got lost in that thought, but, when we go to the outbreak of the Civil War, when he was at Annapolis, really had, for reasons we don't really even fully know about, just had stopped going to classes, stopped showing up at school. He was disappearing for weeks on end, and he really seemed to show no interest. He had no particular respect for what he kind of instructors that he considered academicians. He didn't see them as being hands-on warriors. And Charles Flusser, the mentor that we've mentioned a few times, was one instructor who, in fact, had military experience, and Will looked up to him. Will saw him as a guy who'd seen it all, who was an old soul, who'd been in battles, who'd been at sea, and so he took his word seriously. And then when Will was expelled from the Naval Academy. In fact, he didn't want to go back home because he felt disgraced. He didn't even want to tell his family what happened to him. So again, he disappeared for a number of weeks and showed up at Flusser's door and pretty much said, you know, I have nowhere to go and don't know what to do. And Flusser took him in, and he stayed with Flusser for a number of weeks. And it was kind of during that time when the Civil War broke out and the Naval Academy had to move from Annapolis, and Flusser was part of was in charge of moving a lot of the stuff out and onto the ship that was moving it to the temporary Naval Academy in Rhode Island. And I'm losing my thought. And that was really when Will, under Flusser's wing, started participating in a few little operations that Flusser organized. So again, it was really that he was given an opportunity, and that was really when he began to see that he could function once he was on a vessel, once he was in action, once he had some authority, once he could actually physically do things. That was where this guy flowered. And had he not had that chance, we wouldn't be talking about him today.
Well, that's why I think this story is inspiring. And I'm glad you mentioned about that. You also, at that age, like, sort of the word might be floundering around. You're not sure what you want to do. You're not sure where you want to go. And sometimes it is I know for my problem was, and I skipped almost my entire senior year in high school, simply because I had already read all the books, and I had read more books than...
We were at the same... So in other words, if we were at the same high school, well, since I grew up in Brooklyn, we would have been hanging out at the park.
That's it. I that's what I always felt about you. It's so funny. When I met you, I was thinking that the very first time I met you at Bouchikon, I was thinking, if we had gone to high school together, we would have been the ones skipping school all the time, because we just were so interested in so many things, and there's the reading and all of this, and we wanted to do something with it, and all of that sort of nonsense sitting around in school wasting our time. So I think we'd have been great pals. I always felt that from the minute I met you. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same way.
I don't advocate for it because it's
not
the easiest way.
No, it's not. I mean, and I think we're sort of, I think we've proven, you know, over the years, by our hard work, that we're somebody. But with Will, it was, you know, so wonderful that he had somebody to keep him going there. And then when he hit his stride, he really hit his stride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was given various levels of authority on different naval vessels, and ultimately was given command of a ship. Just to take one quick back step, one of the reasons he was able to get his to get through the door was, again, it was circumstance. After he was kicked out of the academy, and the Civil War broke out, there was a real shortage of manpower, and in this case, we're talking about officer class men in the Union Navy. So suddenly, they were scrambling to get people to man these posts. And here was a guy who had some experience and who had a couple of advocates, Flusser among them, and another relative of his also being included there. So the Secretary of the Union Navy gave him a chance. However, he was not reinstated into the Naval Academy, nor was he given initially the opportunity to become an officer. He was made a midshipman, which would not normally have led to any sort of officer's position, but he took what he could get, and ultimately that changed during the course of the war, and he was made an officer. Ultimately, a little bit later on, he captained his own ships and then became a commander. late in his career. But each time he was given the opportunity to lead men into battle, he just, to say he excelled kind of understates it. He took on these missions that were almost doomed to fail, and he turned them into resounding successes. Sometimes a couple of ships got totaled in the process, that's sometimes, that's just the way it is. We are talking about war, but he ended up impressing admirals and all his higher ups until they had no choice but to realize what his abilities were. And that's why when it came time to destroy or to try to destroy the CSS Albemarle again, it had turned large battleships into splinters. It was called a ram, and the reason for that was that's how it attacked, for the most part, that's how it attacked other vessels. It rammed them. It had a huge armored tusk, so to speak, in front, and it would just go right through them, and that's what it did. It was unstoppable. The only way to stop it, Will discovered, or at least theorized at first, was to get under its metal armor. And in order to do that, you weren't going to take it on with a ship its size. You had to find a way to use a smaller vessel to get underneath it. And that was what Will did. And again, without giving anything away, he went on this greatest escapade with two small boats with 13 men each, so a total of 26 men against a 365-foot armored warship that was heavily patrolled, heavily crewed, and there were Confederate forces on either side of the harbor in which he undertook this mission. So here were 26 men against hundreds, and they had all sorts of weapons.
Well, it's an exciting book. It's called Civil War Commando, William Cushing and the Daring Raid to Sink the Ironclad CSS Albemarle. Now, I don't have much more time, but I want to ask you, you're coming back soon. When's the next book coming out?
About 3 weeks from now. I'm very excited. My next NetForce novel is coming out, and it's called Threat Point, and I love it, and hopefully people listening to this show will as well.
Well, I will have you back for that. And meanwhile, what is your website so that people can go there?
They can find me at jeromepreisler.com, and you can also find my Amazon page, and I'm also on Facebook.
Okay. Well, everybody, get this wonderful book. It's, again, Civil War Commando. That's all you need to know, because this is an exciting thriller. You will love it. I love it. I think it should be a Pulitzer Prize winning book, because it is terrific. And it is a book that will last through the centuries. And you will be famous 300 years from now when the people are reading books on Mars. How about that?
I'm knocking wood. Thank you so much, Patsy. I love being on your show. You are the best of all radio hosts.
Oh, thank you, Jerome. That's so sweet of you. And as I said, I'll send you an email, and we'll confirm the date so you can come back and talk about the new book, okay?
Great. Really look forward to it.
Okay. Thank you now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. Oh, I love him. He's so good. Jerome Preisler is one of, you know, you get these authors that somehow you just relate to them, and all of his books, when I get into his books, I forget about everything. But then when I got this book, this Civil War Commando, I mean, I was lost. I just couldn't put it down. So I hope that you get that, and it's a wonderful gift, absolutely wonderful gift. Thanksgiving's coming up. It's a great book to read on Thanksgiving Day. And you just, after the turkey and you need to relax, I would get this book. Now, we're going to play another literary gem from Jim Lamb. And I want to thank everyone for the wonderful emails I'm getting from all of you people who are working this month on NaNoWriMo, and you are looking for some advice. So here's another bit from Jim Lamb.
Let's say you're a writer. You want to create suspense, dramatic tension. Here's a literary device you might just like. It's called foreshadowing, and it's a great way to set expectations for your readers. I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. When done correctly, foreshadowing is a breadcrumb for the reader, a clue, a nudge, a wink, an inkling about what's to come in the future. It could be right in the title, like Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express, or Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Sometimes a song can foreshadow where a story is going, like Dorothy singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow in The Wizard of Oz. Or it could be a particular phrase like, I see dead people in The Sixth Sense. In fact, phrases are my favorite foreshadowing technique. Here are some examples. Remember when Han Solo said, I've got a bad feeling about this. I had a bad feeling about it too. Or how about when Juliet said of Romeo, go ask his name. If he be married, my grave is like to be my wedding bed. Talk about a hint. In Lord of the Flies, William Golding wrote a line that, in my opinion, absolutely nailed it. We've got to have rules and obey them. After all, we're not savages. But foreshadowing doesn't have to accomplish its goal with words or phrases. It could be a color, like the use of red in The Sixth Sense. The unsettling action by our fine-feathered friends in Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Threatening weather in Twister, Wizard of Oz, and The Perfect Storm. The mercy killing of a dog in Of Mice and Men. Or perhaps the most successful foreshadowing example of all time. The music in Jaws. Ba-dump, 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 ba-dump. So the next time you want to entice readers, consider dropping a hint, a crumb, a nudge, or a wink. It might just turn your book into a real page-turner. I'm Jim Lamb, and you've just learned a little something-something about foreshadowing.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and then I'm just waiting for a call in from Daniel DeVise, and we are going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, B.B. King, because I tried to be a guitarist, and so I am looking forward to talking to him about this wonderful new book that he's written called King of the Blues, and he's calling in a few minutes. Meanwhile, I want to remind everyone, go to my website, radio-joyonpaper. And for all of you people who are taking up this NaNoWriMo challenge and writing a novel, your first novel this month, wow, this is exciting. Just like Rhonda Green, who was on the program a few weeks ago. And it is a good example. If you are thinking about, you know, what should I do to write a book? You can go to my website and look at the interview I had with Rhonda Green, and you can find out about her book, because she wrote it as a challenge. And what did she do? She wrote it, then after a month, and once she finished, she edited it and worked on it and taught herself how to publish it herself and how to market it herself. And she has done an absolutely fantastic job. And so you can find that on my webpage, radio-joyonpaper. And you can also go to Jim Lamb's page there. It's right at the top of the website on the homepage. And he has all the literary gems that he has been recording for us. All these little points that you should know about when you're writing. And it will inspire you. So please do that today. Check out my website, and I think you will find a lot of information there, and you will be inspired both by Jim Lamb, who is a fantastic, he's recently done our new press release for Joy on Paper, and everyone here wants to thank him so much. Devon Miller, Rita Moreau, and Carol Perry all want to thank him so much for this wonderful press release he did for them, because it is very important that we get everybody's name out there. That's the key to, really to getting more books sold and more people reading, is to get names of authors and to get inspired. And so I'm really happy that Jim has done that for us. And you can find his page on my website at radio-joyonpaper. And in a few minutes, he's just calling in because, as I said, this is a subject that is dear to my heart. And it's funny, we all know about B.B. King, and we all know about Lucille. And so I am so happy to welcome to the program Daniel DeVise. Is that the right way to pronounce it, Daniel?
Oh, DeVise.
DeVise. I am sorry. What am I? I see it. This is what happens. Sometimes I have French people on. I don't know if you're French, but I have French people on, with French names, and I pronounce it the French way, and then that turned out to be wrong. So I love it. It's much more elegant. Daniel DeVise. It's beautiful.
Well, thank you.
And you have written, and of course I should mention that you are also a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and a fantastic, all of your work is fantastic. But this new book, King of the Blues, oh, this one got me because it is, of course, about the rise and reign of B.B. King. And when I was 14, I got my first guitar, and I named my guitar George. But I named everything George. I named my car George. I have a 10-foot giraffe outside my front door. His name is George. But you have to tell us about B.B. King and Lucille.
Yeah, well, B.B. King named his guitar Lucille, and I think it happened in 1949. This would be when he first arrived in Memphis, and he was trying to make a name for himself as a radio performer. He sort of talked his way onto the historic first black radio station, WDIA, which featured all black talent, so that's really cool. And B.B. became one of their roster, first of performers. And then later on, he became a DJ. And the story goes that he was playing in Twist, Arkansas, which is a tiny municipality outside of Memphis, well outside of Memphis. And a fire broke out at the roadhouse where he was playing, and supposedly the fire started as a fist fight, which started over a woman who might have been a waitress at the restaurant at the Roadhouse, and B.B. raced into the blaze to collect his guitar so it wouldn't be ruined because he couldn't really afford another one. And then after the fire had been put out, he inquired and found out that the woman over whom the fight had started was named Lucille. And so that was the name he gave to his guitar.
Wow. You know, this guitar is, it has to be the most famous guitar in the world.
As far as named guitars, there's like Trigger, I think, is Willie Nelson's guitar. And, you know, Albert King named his guitar, I think, Lucy, sort of in homage to B.B. And there's a lot of other, I think Neil Young's guitar has a name. I'm not going to remember what it is. But, yeah, there's no one else like Lucille. It's the best known by far.
And as I said, I started playing the guitar. Well, I played the accordion first, and I played polkas.
Really?
Yeah. And then that was when I was very young. I was playing polkas. And then, you know, when I got a little older, I said, well, I want to be, you know, a folk singer. And, you know, so I learned how to play the guitar. And, of course, B.B. King was one of the inspirations, and you just wish that you could play like two notes that sound like him.
Yeah, well, me too. You and me both. I'm a bad guitar player myself. Well, you'll appreciate, as a musician, I think the reason that you get vibrato in the guitar in the first place, you know, the solo style of guitar with kind of the tremolo sound, you get that because some of the early pioneers of the guitar, like Lonnie Johnson, the great black blues and jazz artist of the 20s, I think he'd started on the violin. And if you play the violin, you learn to play vibrato, and I think he transferred that skill set over to the guitar, and that's maybe where the vibrato style of solo guitar was born. And this, you know, lineage works its way to B.B. like two, three decades later.
And, of course, one of his inspirations was Blind Lemon Jefferson. And I love that man's work.
Yeah, I say in my book, it's a little hard to fully appreciate Blind Lemon Jefferson, the great Texas artist, who was almost the only big star who played folk blues on guitar and accompanied with his voice. And the reason for that is that all of the Delta greats from the 30s, including Robert Johnson, maybe the best known, were playing during the Depression, and so they didn't sell any records, really. I mean, I think Robert Johnson had one minor hit, but, you know, it was a terrible economic era to be making music. So there was really only one big star of Delta blues guitar back then, and that would have been Charlie Patton. And the only reason he broke through was that he started before the crash. And Blind Lemon Jefferson had many hits, again, before the stock market crash, which is real interesting. And this is also why B.B. King knew and loved the work of Blind Lemon, so I'm glad you mentioned him. But B.B. knew almost nothing of Robert Johnson or Son House or Skip James, because they just didn't sell records, and so there's no way he would have heard them in the 40s and the 50s.
Well, B.B. King is, you know, he did so many wonderful things, and we don't have a long time to talk. So let's talk a little bit about about some of the wonderful and fantastic things he did just to promote humanity. He was such a big, wonderful influence on people.
Well, yeah, there hadn't been much written at all about his work in the civil rights movement. And I think I found out later this was because he did it all kind of behind the scenes. I didn't find a single clipping from a newspaper or a magazine or a book really talking about B.B. King playing like at fundraisers for Dr. King or just other work to sort of support the civil rights movement in the 60s and maybe even in the 50s. But apparently he did a lot of that work, and he did it with great humility and great modesty, and did it behind the scenes, kind of in private. But apparently he was a very important, very instrumental performer at fundraising dinners and that sort of thing. But, you know, there was no record of it because it was all very, very, very private. And then in the 70s, when you reach the 10-year anniversary of the brutal slaying of Medgar Evers, then B.B. starts very publicly going back to Mississippi every year and honoring the legacy of Medgar Evers, and there begins this annual tradition of, you know, homecomings that continues almost until Mr. King's death, and that you know, that's very well documented because these were big, joyous celebrations.
Well, this was big research for you, this book.
Yeah, you know, I wrote the proposal, which anybody who knows publishing, a proposal is like 100 pages, so it's almost like a book unto itself. And I think I did that in 2017. And then I sold the book, and then in the first months of 2018, I went down to Memphis and to Mississippi and to Nashville and to the Delta and the Hill Country, yada, yada, and visited where Mr. King was born and where he died in the museum, the B.B. King Museum, which is wonderful. And then I spent 2018 and 2019 writing the book. And then 2020, the public health crisis hit, and I was sort of sidelined along with most of my sources, and I had some time. So I actually went and deleted a lot of stuff that I didn't like in the book, and I looked for kind of movie scenes, stuff that felt like cinematic scenes, because people like reading those, I think, because you can kind of appreciate it with all of your senses. And I took those scenes and tried to bulk them up, you know, to make them better. I called back a lot of my sources because we were all sitting around, right? All of us doing not much. And I interviewed people again and again and tried to make the book even better for that whole year of 2020. And so the result, I think, is probably, for what it's worth, I think it's my best written book because I spent more time on it than I had on any of my prior books.
Well, the pandemic-y thing, you know, I'm trying to get this word, I should trademark this word, pandemic and icky. If you combine them, it's pandemic-y. And so that's how I think of this period in our lives, pandemic-y.
Yeah.
But it did give you time to really fine-tune this book. And I'm glad that you mentioned cinematography, because I used to work in Hollywood. So I think in terms of film. When I'm reading a book, I see a book, and because I was responsible for taking, you know, some books, some really boring books, by the way, and write a script for them. Just, you know, nonfiction books that were really difficult to write a script for, because I had to make up most of it. But with yours, I mean, I was seeing it in my head as a film.
Well, that's high praise. I've not yet had a book cinematized, and you know better than I do how few of the books that are optioned ever get made into films. Yeah, I think this book might represent my best shot, but it's a rare and wonderful privilege. And I always flip when I see somebody who's a big writer complaining and kvetching about the film that did this wrong and did that wrong. I mean, I would be thanking everyone I had ever met if a book of mine were made into a film. Oh, my God.
Well, I'm telling you, Hollywood should option this. Because, first of all, the script writers assigned to it, and there are many, you know, I would be like, sometimes I would be like the third or fourth script writer who'd get a book. I was always happy when I was the first one. Because I knew that they'd come along and do all the changes. But this one, any script writer worth a grain of salt would just say, oh, thank God, I have a book I can work with. And this book would be so great. And I'm telling everybody out there, and I have some listeners in Hollywood, because I wrote a script actually for Debbie Reynolds once, and so I have some friends out there. And if you're listening, get this book. You could have so much fun. It of course would take years because you know they go through so many hands; it just drives you crazy.
Yeah.
It makes you almost insane. But really, a script writer would love to work with this book.
Can you tell me one that you cinematized that where the book felt like it was easy to do into it? I mean, I don't know if you're at liberty to.
No, I'm not. I'll tell you. I could tell you one disaster book. I got this book. It was by a very famous person, very famous nonfiction book, and they said write this script. I got paid to write a script. I turned it into a love story because he had only 10 minutes, 10 pages in that whole book that was worth anything. So it's in turnaround. It's in turnaround. And you never know. You know, it could, I have four or five film scripts in turnaround. And you never know. Sometimes something will pop and they'll be done. But they should really get this book because I think it's great. And it's called King of the Blues. The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. And Daniel Devise, I think it's just, I always admire an author who really gets into the subject, does this fantastic research, because people don't understand what it takes to do this kind of research and what you've done here, and because many of the people were difficult to get to, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I can draw on 20-some years as a newspaper reporter. If you're a newspaper reporter, you have to find people who are difficult to find, and you have to find them quickly. I have that skill set to this day. Just for example, I was able to track down John Landis, the famous filmmaker, pretty easily. I don't think that somebody who didn't have newspaper skills would have known where to look for him, but I found him, and he wound up his voice wound up in the book. Thank goodness. I mean, it's all different skills that go into writing a book. I mean, for one thing, I'll just give you one challenge. The man did 17,000 gigs, and if you're the writer or if you're the script writer, how many of those gigs go in the film? How many different gigs? You can't have 17,000 gigs in one film. You can have one, you can have five. I mean, you have to figure out where to draw the line, and a lot of what I was doing was figuring out how many of those gigs to make into scenes, right? And then it's even fewer once you make the film.
You know, I'm running out of time, and because they've got me on a strict thing that we have to end this soon. What's your website where you want people to go, or Facebook or whatever?
It's my name, DanielDevise.com. If you type in B.B. King book, you'll find it most likely, and that's all my little plaudits are on there.
Okay, well, Daniel Devise, it's a wonderful book, fantastic book. I'm going to play you out with some music, and I want to tell people this is a wonderful, you know, it's a perfect gift, because we all, there are so many of us out there who are wannabe guitarists, and everybody will just love this book, and it's just a great gift. The holidays are coming up, and if you pull out your guitar, some people only pull out their guitar at Thanksgiving nowadays. You know, you get older and you say, well, I'll take it out of the closet, and you strum a little. They should have this book to inspire them to keep working. You never know. You might get that vibrato. Thank you so much, Daniel Devise, for being on Joy and Paper today.
It's been my honor. Thank you.
And if you get a movie deal, you come back and announce it here, okay?
Okay, it's a deal.
Okay, great. And we're going to play you out now with some music.
The thrill is gone away.